Excuse me, does that actually include the amendment?
Yes, that does include the amendment relative to the March 4th memo from Mr. Harper relative to Commissioner Bretner's concerns, the transitory development, the typos and the things that have had discussion and consensus here.
Thank you. And a second?
Second.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Any opposed? Okay, motion carries. Thank you. Let's see. All right, we'll move on to the presentation of the new Comstock Wind project. And Mr. Whitney, thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Commissioners. Bill Whitney with the Department of Community Development. Tonight, our friends from the Carson City District Office of the Bureau of Land Management are on your agenda to inform you about the new Comstock Wind project. I thought with, by way of a little background on the Bureau of Land Management and how we work with them in Washoe County, I'd explain that the county, our county as a whole, is divided into four different district offices of the Bureau of Land Management. We have three district offices for the northern part of the county, and then the Carson City District Office covers the southern part of the county, which is basically all the Truckee Meadows from Carson City through the Truckee Meadows and up to just north of Pyramid Lake. So we've got Surprise Field Office, the Cedarville Field Office, and the Winnemucca Field Office covering the northern part of the county, and the Carson City Field Office covering the southern part. You've already dealt with our first wind project, the Virginia Peak Wind, that's located on private property within Washoe County. The other projects that are in the pipeline are all located on public lands, and that's land managed by the Bureau of Land Management. And they're here tonight to explain their process on one of those that's in the pipeline. They're going to talk to you about their environmental impact study process, and that's something that we've been coordinating with the Bureau of Land Management on for years here in Washoe County. In fact, some of the EISs from the past that you might recognize are the North Valley's Water Importation Project. That's not too far in the past. That's also known as Fish Springs. The Granite Fox Coal-Fired Power Project. The update to the resource management plans for the Surprise and the Eagle Lake field offices up there in the northern part of the county. Going a little further back, we had the Tracy to Silver Lake Power Transmission Line, EIS, and then the Reno Clay Plant Project. That's going even further back. That was also known as Oil Dry, if you remember that. And then the Alturas 345 KV Transmission Line was also one we coordinated with them on. They're going to explain their EIS process to you, but I thought it would be interesting for you to know how that information that's and the data that's in that EIS when it's completed, how that's used by the county in our application processes. So towards the end of an EIS process, usually we see the project proponent come into the county with their application for a special use permit or whatever it is they need. And then we'll accept that application, and then the clock starts ticking for us on that time on that application. About that time, the EIS draft is becoming a final EIS, and the county has participated with the Bureau of Land Management all along as a cooperating agency usually in these processes. So then our staff member that's assigned that special use permit for that proposed project then can take the information from that EIS that's just finishing up, and that can help our staff member write the staff report for your the Planning Commission staff report and help with the conditions of approval in that staff report. It gives us more information and makes for a better analysis. And then so we're finishing up our approval process on the project. The Bureau of Land Management is then finishing up with their EIS process, and then they'll get to their record of decision as the last item they do. And they can actually, if they choose to, they can take some of our conditions of approval and incorporate those into their record of decision. They don't have to, but they can. And that's been done in the past, and that makes for really a tight coordination of both agencies' processes and works really well. The Carson City Field Office is divided into two, I'm sorry, the Carson City District Office of the Bureau of Land Management is divided into two field offices. Stillwater Field Office is in other counties south of us and east of us, and the Sierra Front Field Office is the one that covers our area particularly. And from the Sierra Front Field Office, the manager of that field office is here with a lot of other folks from her office, and I'd like to introduce her, Linda Kelly. She'll come up and give you her presentation. Thanks.
Thank you, Bill. You did a great explanation. I'm Linda Kelly. I'm the Sierra Front Field Office Manager. Back in October, the Bureau of Land Management, Carson City District Office, reorganized, and we were split up, like Bill said, into two field offices, and Washoe County falls into the Sierra Front Field Office. And this evening, this evening we're going to give a presentation on our environmental impact statement process, which we call NEPA, National Environmental Policy Act process, and also talk about cooperating agencies. This evening I have some folks with me. Behind me and to my right, Ken Nelson, who's our realty specialist, he's in blue. Jane Peterson, who's going to give the presentation on the NEPA process, she's in lavender. And then on my left, Dan Jacquet, who's our community relations liaison, he's in yellow. And Mark Struble, our public information officer, he's in, I guess you'd say, a white or tan shirt, a BLM shirt. And they will be here to help us answer any questions. In addition, the proponent from Great Basin Wind, who's sitting behind Jane and Ken, Rich Hamilton, is here, and he'll be able to answer any technical questions. So this evening we're going to talk about the NEPA process, the cooperating agency status, and what the next steps are. So I'd like to turn it over to Jane.
Madam Chair, Commission, thank you for having us here tonight. Let me see if I can make this work. Here we go. Okay, again, thank you for having us here tonight. Linda gave a great overview of what the presentation is going to be about. This is for informational purposes only. Just wanted to let you know what we're doing and how potentially Washoe County can fit into our process. A quick overview of the project. I am not going to do a detailed presentation on the project itself, but here's an overview of what the project is. It's approximately 71 wind turbines. They will vary in height between 210 and 330 feet tall. Some of the typical questions we get are blade length, and the blades, depending on the type of turbine that's going to be used, can vary between 115 and 170 feet per blade. Another aspect of this project proposal is underground electrical lines, and those will be the lines that actually collect the power between the turbines. Once the power is collected, they'll go to a substation. There'll be 5 miles of 120 kilovolt transmission line that will go to the substation. In addition, some of the ancillary parts of this project are the access roads that they will need between the turbines for maintenance and for access to the turbines, and then, of course, miscellaneous storage buildings and yards. So that was just a quick overview of the project itself. I wanted to talk more about what the BLM process is here. And these projects, a wind development project, is done using a right-of-way. And BLM has the authority to grant rights-of-way for projects on public lands by the federal Land Policy and Management Act. That's our organic act. That's what gives us the authority to do things on behalf of the American people on public lands. In a case like this, a right-of-way is an authorization to use a specific piece of land for a certain project for a term appropriate to the life of the project. In addition, a right-of-way specifies, the FLTMA specifies the authority for the BLM to grant right-of-ways specifically for systems that would generate, transmit, and distribute electric energy. Further authority comes from the Energy Policy Act from 2005, which actually states that 10,000 megawatts of renewable energy projects will be located on public lands by the year 2015. So now talking specifically about this project and how it fits into the right-of-way process, Great Basin Wind came into the BLM in June 2006 and received a right-of-way application for monitoring and testing, and that's the very first phase of wind energy development. That's where they come in, and with a right-of-way, they're allowed to put monitoring devices on public land to test the wind resource out there. April 2008, last year, they came back to the BLM with testing results that supported them going into development and came in with an application for commercial development, right-of-way for commercial development, which is a different right-of-way from the previous monitoring and testing right-of-way. In addition, as part of that application process, Great Basin Wind brought a plan of development to us, and that's what we base our process on, especially the analysis process. The BLM has chosen to develop an environmental impact statement. That's the highest level of detailed analysis that we do through our process. Once we get through that entire process, we will make a decision on approval of the right-of-way. That, again, is after the EIS process is completed. And the decision on the right-of-way is determined by the outcome of the environmental impact statement. Determination if the proposal is in the public interest, and then consistency with federal, state, and local laws are our main guidance on our final decision on a right-of-way. A little bit about the National Environmental Policy Act, NEPA. I'm sure you've heard that term before. NEPA is a public interdisciplinary process, and it's for federal agencies. When a federal agency takes action, before we make a decision on that action, we're required to go through the process to make sure that we are have done an informed decision-making process. The NEPA also has a particular process. That's extremely important for NEPA, that we follow the process, and especially when we're doing an environmental impact statement. Following the process step by step is extremely important to a successful completion. Another very important part of the NEPA is that we disclose information that we support, that we use to support the decisions that we make. We disclose that to the public. NEPA is a very public process, and that's one reason we're here tonight, because it's a good way to get out to people who have a constituency in the public, and the information you have and can be a part of this process helps our decision-making process. So really quickly, this is a kind of a small flow chart. It just talks about the NEPA process. And basically, real quickly, a proposal comes into the agency. We have a few routes that we can take. There's sometimes where a NEPA process does not need to be completed. That would be a categorical exclusion. Usually, though, we have to go into an analysis process. We can choose to go to an environmental assessment, and the outcome of an environmental assessment is a finding of no significant impact. And, of course, an environmental assessment, you might have heard of an EA before. Or the other outcome would be an environmental impact statement. The agency also has the choice to go directly into the environmental impact statement process, and that's what we're doing with this project. And then this whole flowchart line down on the right talks about what the EIS process is. The big thing here that I want to point out is the red squares are the squares where the public involvement is required as part of the NEPA process. But we can talk about the components of the environmental impact statement. Right now, we're basically in the scoping process. That's the very initial stage of the environmental impact statement. We go out to the public. We get issues and concerns from as many different factors of the public as we can. The next step we would do is we develop for the environmental impact statement the purpose and need for why we are doing the impact statement. We develop alternatives. We actually do the analysis itself. All this leads into drafting the environmental impact statement. At the time we get a draft completed is when we go back out to the public again. The draft EIS is made available for public review. We will have public meetings. We have a set public review period. And then we go back, and any comments that we get from the public or from our cooperating agencies, then we determine if changes need to be made to the draft environmental impact statement, any modifications, we respond to comments, and then when we get through that process is when we come back out with the final environmental impact statement. Again, it goes out to the public gets a chance to look at it, and the very last step in the process is when the BLM develops a record of decision, and that's where that decision comes into it that I talked about before. We take different factors into account as we develop the record of decision. So we are in the scoping process right now. We formally had a scoping period that lasted until the January 31st of this year. On December 10th, we had a scoping meeting at the BLM. About 80 people attended. Throughout our entire scoping process, we've received about 95 comments, and interestingly enough, it's almost half and half people who support the project and people who don't support the project. The people who are opposing the project actually support wind development, but we have identified concerns with the people with this project itself. All of these things go into our process and factor in as we develop alternatives. Again, 17 miscellaneous comments and 13 people of the almost 100 comment submissions just wanted to be on the mailing list. We also received comments from seven agencies, including the EPA has commented on it, Fish and Wildlife Service, Nevada Division of Department of Wildlife, the State Department of Cultural Affairs, Story County, and the Silver City Advisory Board have all commented on it. So what some of the issues that we identified throughout our scoping process, you can see here, of course, I think you probably understand that visual resource impacts were probably the most commonly commented issue that we received. Cultural is also another one. Noise was very much a concern with local citizens. And then typically we have the wildlife recreation. Electromagnetic interference has been brought up as well. Socioeconomic is always an important one, how this will socioeconomically adversely and benefit the local economy. Wildfire, invasive species, emergency services, and then travel management and transportation both. This would probably, there was concerns about the roads, the existing roads, and then roads that would have to be built as access roads for the project. I'd like to talk a little bit about cooperating agencies. Mr. Whitney brought up a cooperating agency status. We have every intention of inviting Washoe County to be a cooperating agency with us. Our objective in getting good cooperating agency involvement is to gain early involvement is very important. Our cooperating agencies bring in local knowledge, and especially of the economic, social, and environmental conditions locally. And then state and local land use requirements, that they also bring that to our table. We can address intergovernmental issues when we have good cooperating agency involvement. It avoids duplication of effort. It encourages support for decisions that we might make, but probably most importantly of all is that we build or continue to build relationships of trust and cooperation with our cooperating agencies. So, to be a cooperating agency, there are eligibility criteria. The biggest criteria are that the agency has jurisdiction by law or special expertise. And one thing that we would request of a cooperating agency is that they sign a memorandum of understanding with us that establishes roles and responsibilities that carry throughout the process. And the process usually can take anywhere from a year to 2 years for something like this. So it's a long-term relationship with our cooperating agencies. And these are some ways the cooperating agency participates in various steps of the process. One of the very most important things is collecting data. There's a lot of data that our cooperating agencies have. They also identify interest groups out there and other organizations. They help us identify alternatives as they come to the table when we're in that part of the process. Assistance in the analysis, especially analysis where they have the special expertise, is critical. And when we get comments at the draft EIS stage, having our cooperators assist us in responding to those comments and determining how the responses need to be formulated. One thing we'd like to point out that when it comes to the NEPA process itself and the right-of-way decisions that we make, the BLM, the decision-making responsibility will remain with the BLM, just for the NEPA and the right-of-way decisions that we as the BLM have to take on. Other people made this look a lot easier. So the next steps forward, the schedule that we have right now, it's a draft schedule. Of course, as we identify issues and go through the process, the draft schedule can change, but we're looking at the draft EIS coming out late this year, getting through the public comment period, responding to those comments will probably take us to the middle of next year, and hopefully we'll have a record of decision completed by the end of next year. That's our schedule right now. And that's all I have for tonight. I appreciate your time. I'm here for questions. If you have technical questions, we have everybody we can think of that can answer questions for you. So thank you.
Thank you. Any questions?
I've got one question on the Virginia project, the transmission lines that were drawn in so that they just barely hit corners of BLM property, and there wasn't a problem with that. Could you elaborate just a little bit on that process? We were concerned about this. We wanted to have joint transmission lines and so on, so we're only going to tear up one section of the mountains rather than two, and then there was special consideration because almost all of their transmission line is on private property, but then there was the corner catch where it was BLM, and that was stated as not a concern.
Madam Chair, this sounds like this is a discussion of Virginia Peak.
No.
Relevant to Virginia Peak?
How is something like this addressed? Let's just take Virginia Peak out of it. When you're mixing up corners on transmission lines.
To be honest, Commissioner, that's kind of difficult, and to speak theoretically about it, I don't want to get in any trouble, because our process, when people come to us and have an instance such as that, we would really have to look at the actual impacts that would occur. Many times corner crossings require the minimum level of NEPA analysis, which would be that categorical exclusion. However, there could be extenuating circumstances that relate to the project itself that would change that. That would be whether or not maybe a pole had to go someplace. So it's a difficult question to answer without having an actual proposal in place that we could actually look at what's happening and how that relates to what we have done in the past, what type of NEPA we have already completed, and exactly what the potential impacts could be based on knowing what that project is.
So you do have just a little bit of latitude to work with where you can. It's not a problem it deemed by somebody.
Corner crossings are not unusual.
So, and that's a typical, or not an unusual thing. That was pretty much my question. It just seemed like what could be accomplished would be less construction on these routes if there was also joint consideration for somebody that's going strictly through BLM.
And those are the types of things we encourage having as comments, even in the comment on this project, and we can take that back and analyze those comments as it applies.
Thank you.
Commissioner Edwards.
I think I'd like to direct my questions to Ms. Kelly, please. I have sat through a bunch of the hearings on the coal-fired power plant out in Ely out there. Excuse me. I also read their NEPA, scanned it. I didn't read it. It was 3 inches thick, their first part of their NEPA process, first part of their draft EIS, all the stuff they had on hand. And what we're doing here at this, or what you guys are doing here with your going through this process for the EIS, the NEPA, and all that for this wind project, seems to me the same process that every other developer is going to go through that wants to put a project across on over whatever a BLM property. Now, why is it every developer has to go through EIS, has to go through NEPA, has to do this for each project? I mean, one wind project may be on a sandy hilltop as opposed to a solid rock hilltop, but the process and the questions that you guys have outlined in this and you outlined in that NEPA process for that coal-fired power plant were exactly the same. And what I'm seeing here is like this one project was started in 06 just to get information, and this is 09 coming up in a couple months on June of 09, 3 full years for this project. And we've got a bunch of projects that we have in the we're looking at coming before us in the future that will be using BLM properties. And I'm just seeing that that these projects keep getting pushed off and keep getting more and more costly because they have to go through this exact same EIS NEPA project for every one of them. Now, isn't there some way that you and your people could streamline this process by saying, you know, if you're going to have a wind project, we're going to have 20 of the same concerns for your project as for this other person's project, and we've dealt with them. We'll have to get the community input, of course, like you would do for every project. But there's got to be some way to streamline this. You can't have these people that maybe would walk away from a project that our community needs because the project has to go through these all these steps, and it just beleaguers them right out of the project possibility entirely. Isn't there some way your staff and your people could put together something that applies to, you know, all projects of this type? So now you just have to do these items that are specific to your area. We've already answered these questions on these other items and speed this process up some.
Sometimes, sir, we can, Commissioner, we can tear off of other planning documents to develop the environmental impact statement. But each project, like Jane talked about in the previous example, are specific to a particular area, and the impacts are specific to a particular area. And we have to address, through scoping, identify what those impacts are, and then also address what the public comments are associated with it in order to make sound planning decisions in the process. But sometimes we do share over that, documents.
I can't believe that each one of these processes, each one of these projects has to go through this entire process. You know, this is just such a classic example of how the I hate to say government process, me being one of them, just ends up, you know, making the process so complicated and so involved that everybody just throws their hands up and say that we can't even work with this process. You know, just take this wind project, for instance. Mm-hmm. The same concerns about noise and vibrations and bird deaths and environmental site impacts, and that's going to be the same on every project. How is that going to change from one to the other?
Well, there may be some mitigating factors related to visual impact or noise or those kinds of things, and the communities will come out and they will say, you know, we are concerned about visual impacts and what a turbine might look like from, you know, a particular vantage point.
Everybody's going to have that.
Yeah.
So why isn't that just automatically in every wind project? And why isn't the noise automatically in every wind project? And what I'm saying is there's got to be some way to streamline this, and I don't see it happening. I see that every project has the same questions, the same steps, and has to answer the same questions, and the answers come out to be exactly the same. We're just doing the same thing over and over and over, and that has some kind of a definition of something. But if our developers are going to do any meaningful stuff in our county, and they have to go through this, I think our county is going to be injured by the fact of the complication of these processes. And I for one, would really like to see your department get on board with streamlining this somehow, taking everything for a wind project and putting this in some kind of a packet, everything for a coal-fired power plant. Those concerns are going to be the same whether it's in Ely or it's in downtown Reno. And, you know, saying, okay, these are the concerns, these are what we found out, open it up to public comment if there's something, you know, specific that you might not know about. But you got to be able to streamline this process somehow. And I would encourage, and I would really like to see this happen, because we know we've got four or five more projects in our future. I would really encourage and like to see BLM step up. And I know you've got some really qualified people here that ought to be able to package this somehow so that you can skip some of these steps, 3 and 4 and 5 and 6 years for a project, to get through an EIS, a NEPA, and a EIS draft, and then the final, and then the ROD. This is ridiculous. Okay. That's my point. Thanks.
You know, in defense of the BLM, and I don't dispute what you're saying, Commissioner Edwards, at all, but, I mean, they're following some very strict guidelines that are laid out by the federal government. I mean, they don't get to go in and just say, you know what, we don't like this, we're not going to do it. We think it should be done differently. So to me, if you want things to be changed in that regard, the persons to be talking to are your congressmen and your senators, because these people are, correct me if I'm wrong here, but they're kind of handed down to you, this is what you're going to be doing, right? I mean, you don't get to necessarily say, well, we don't like that one, so we're not going to do it. I mean, am I wrong here? But I understand there's a lot of regulations at the federal level, and you're subjected to them is my assumption.
Madam Chair, I'm all for these environmental impact studies. They probably, like Roger said, a lot of it is repetitious and it could be streamlined, but there's also ways around it, and that's been a concern too.
My concern is that people on the inside, you folks, and didn't I see you at that coal-fired power plant?
Yes, sir, you did.
Okay. I thought we had this talk there, too. But you people are the folks on the inside. You're the ones that have to labor through this every time. I mean, I would think that you guys would be the ones to say to Harry Reid or whoever, like, I can't believe he even reads the list, but whoever are the ones coming down. If it's legislators, they would certainly listen to somebody from the department on the inside saying, we have to go through this every time. There's got to be some way to streamline this or improve the process or something. I'm not trying to dodge any concerns about any project. Don't think that for a minute. But what I'm talking about is a windmill's going to kill birds and bats in Carson just the same as it is up here or in the north part of our county or anywhere else you put a windmill up. It's going to do the same thing. So you address that, and then you package that and say, all right, we're going to have some kind of an impact. We need to get Endow or whoever's going to make that decision on the birds in Carson or the birds in Virginia or the birds up by Winnemucca Ranch and package that. Make that a, now here's the package dealing with that. You've got to be able to speed this process up.
I do have one clarification. And as I stated when I was talking about the NEPA process itself, the environmental impact statement is the highest level of analysis, the most detailed. We do have the ability to, there's a programmatic environmental impact statement that was done for wind energy development. And we can use that programmatic EIS and tier to it with an EA. However, sometimes going into a project, we also understand that there are issues and concerns that might fall outside of that EA process, and that's why we would go to that higher level. One other clarification I would like to make is that while they're doing the monitoring and testing, that was done under its own process. Once they come in and do the plan of development, the development right-of-way, that's when we get into the environmental impact or the environmental analysis as required for development. So even though they had come in 2006, that was a different process. We've only been working on this one since they came in for the development right-of-way. Again, we have heard concerns from the community. A lot of the concerns were the historic landmark concerns, the visual concerns, the concerns for noise, and those were the things that prompted us, instead of going for an environmental assessment, to go that extra step into the environmental impact statement. So there are some avenues that we can streamline this. They're out there, but they don't fit every single project, and this is one project that we didn't feel it fit very well.
That's fine, and that's exactly what I'm talking about. We don't want to dodge things that are site-specific that need to be addressed. But, you know, these projects that we're considering are all going to have access roads. They're all going to have long loads, heavy load problems, conditions. They're almost always going to be in undeveloped areas where we have to put in new roadways, and we have cuts and fills and all this kind of stuff that are dealt with or are part of the main concerns in this project and in all the ones we're going to be considering, trust me. So is there, in your view, no way besides going an EIS or the lesser version, is there no way to streamline this at all?
I think it was pointed out, and I think it was well put, that we do have the process, and part of my presentation was talking about the process itself, and those steps in the process are very well established, and moving away from that process is probably the best way to make the document vulnerable to litigation.
All right, thank you.
Commissioner Lockhart.
Could you or perhaps the project representative, as appropriate, give us an idea of the amount of wind energy that would be generated and how that relates to meeting a community's needs, and also give us some relative information about the location of the project? I don't think I heard either of those in the presentation.
And thank you for bringing that up, Commissioner. Yes, we do have the proponent here, and he could probably give you a real quick run through on that, if that's okay.
I'd like to have that.
Rich Hamilton is the project proponent from Great Basin Wind.
Howdy. Rich Hamilton, Great Basin Wind, Hidden Valley, Nevada. Anyway, that's loud. The project actually is in three counties. The power line, we have 5 miles of power line. I'll run from south heading north. We have 5 miles of power line that runs from the south end of the project down to the Brunswick substation in Carson City. It goes through BLM land until it gets to existing right-of-ways. So we're kind of minimally impacted there, as minimally impacted as we can go. We have 71 turbines on the map. The majority of those are in Washoe County. This pretty much sits right west on the ridge and then west of the ridge line of the Virginia Range. So it's right along the Washoe and Story County lines. And the northern terminus of the project is a mile or two south of Geiger Grade. We're going to be able to utilize existing roads for the most part. There's a lot of impact up there that we're going to be able to use. Again, existing roadways. We're going to have our power lines under the roadways, and we'll have some spur roads that will go off from the existing roads for the turbine rows. I don't know what else to bring up there. Turbines, I think they already talked about size and whatnot.
The question was how much energy and how does relate to a community? Is it going to
support? It's approximately 200 megawatts, and a megawatt of power is about 300 homes.
Sure, Weber.
While you're up there, I had a citizen contact me and ask me about these turbines and where they're manufactured. Is there no American company that makes these?
Actually, most of them are manufactured in the U.S. now. There are only really two American companies. It's General Electric and a company named Clipper. that make, the solely American companies. There's a third one that will come up with, will come up with a utility scale machine soon. Just in the 90s, essentially, all of the technology went overseas is what really happened. And that's how most of the manufacturers are overseas. But what's happened is they've been putting their manufacturing plants. They've been putting their manufacturing plants into the U.S.
So will yours be American-made or Danish or European? Or?
Right now we have a couple of machines, kind of on the list. I'd rather not discuss which one specifically, but at least two of them are made in the U.S.
Any other? Commissioner Lockhart?
For the question, and I think this is for staff, I heard Mr. Hamill say it involves locations in three counties, including Washoe. Will we be seeing it then as a special use permit, as an action item, and how will our consideration relate to that of other counties? What kind of an approval process will we or Washoe County be involved in?
Again, Bill Whitney, Community Development. Commissioner Lockhart, yeah, I think each county will be seeing Carson, Story, and Washoe will be seeing that this as an individual special use permit, an individual action by this body. And we'll interrelate with the other counties through the cooperating agency process that the BLM described. So it'll come to you and you'll make a decision on it. It's that simple.
I have a letter that was requested by Linda Bissett to be read into the record, if I may. Linda Bissett is with the Government Affairs Division of Nevada Energy. Nevada Energy requests that the following statement be read into the record. Renewable energy project development is strongly supported by Nevada Energy, or NV Energy, sorry. By 2015, we expect to reach or exceed the goal of 20% of our power mix being supplied by renewable energy sources, but that depends in large measure on the success of developers in bringing viable projects to us. In pursuing renewable projects to meet that goal, we follow a confidential RFP contract process with potential developers. Because of that confidentiality and to retain the integrity of the process, we do not share information about any particular project or developer. A project's viability and potential cost impacts to our ratepayers are two key components we consider on proposed projects. We are committed to meeting our renewable standard goals at the lowest possible cost to minimize financial impact to customers. Any project that makes it through that RFP process must also gain approval from the Public Utilities Commission of Nevada. Additionally, the transmission line needed to interconnect to our system must be analyzed as to its location, engineering and environmental concerns, other constraints, permitting, including local government support for the project and who will build and maintain it. NV Energy must also meet the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, FERC, open access guidelines in regards to interconnection to our system. Because of the limitations mentioned above, we are unable to provide any information or details on the project before you. However, stated earlier, we do strongly support the development of renewable energy resources such as wind, solar, and geothermal.
Madam Chair?
Yes.
We do have one request to speak.
You do? Okay. Thank you.
Stuart Smith. Pardon me?
Yes. Crossed out. Commissioners, Madam Chair, Danny Costello with the Iron Workers, and I'm probably way premature in addressing you guys about this, seeing it's just a proposal kind of thing, but we, for the record, we are in favor of this, our members, of course, as we are for all alternative energy projects. And then I'd like to say one other thing. When we were here for the the Palomino Valley project, you know, I did have some of the residents there say, well, put it in your backyard. Well, I'm a 32-year resident of Washoe Valley, and I'll be seeing these things. They'll be in my backyard, and I'm for it. I'm walking the walk. So that's my statement. Thank you.
Thank you. All right. I don't think there's no action taken on this at all. It's a presentation, right?
That's correct.
Okay. Well, thank you very much. It
Could
was
I
a great
answer. Answer, ask a question.
Yeah. Go ahead.
Under the cooperating agencies, participate in various steps of the EIS process as feasible. There's an item listed, help identify alternatives. Can you tell me what kind of an alternative there is to a windmill?
There's a variety of ways you can look at alternatives, alternative locations. We talked about the fact that there was a range of size of the turbines. Those turbines also, based on the varying sizes, also have varying impacts. So we could have alternatives that include various turbine sizes. Actual site-specific locations of the turbines could be alternatives. Access roads, doing things with the transmission lines, those are all areas that we can look at alternatives to the project.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, thank you all you feds for coming. It's always good to see you.
And thank you for your time as well.